Namaste and welcome to the Bharat Vartha podcast. I'm Roshan Karyapa. This past week, there were news reports that revealed a mass surveillance operation using a sophisticated software called Pegasus that is developed by an Israeli firm, NSO. The report spanned multiple countries and governments and alleged that around 50,000 phone numbers had been potentially tracked, 300 of them belonging to journalists, ministers, business leaders, human rights activists, and other public personalities from India. The government, of course, has rejected all of these allegations unequivocally. But this does bring up larger questions on government surveillance, right to privacy, and other contentious issues. To make sense of all of this, I have two very special guests with me, both making their debut on Bharat Vartha. First up, we have Karan Datta, who has over 25 years' experience in financial services and has held leadership positions at Goldman Sachs, Axis Mutual, and more. He's also a speaker on prominent geopolitical issues. Welcome, Karan. Glad to have you on the podcast.
Thanks a lot, Roshan. Really, really excited about coming on Bharat Vartha and spending time with you all.
Wonderful. And joining him, we also have Surya Kanegaonkar, who is a finance professional and a trained economist. He's also a columnist for many prominent news outlets, and he writes on Indic culture and global geopolitics as well. Thank you so much for joining us, Surya.
Namaste, Roshan. Thank you for inviting me. Really appreciate it.
Fantastic. So I think we have plenty of ground to cover, right, and nuances to explore. So let me begin with you, Surya. Let's talk about the investigation and the expose itself. I think journalists across countries worked on this project, and it involves multiple governments, I think multiple allegations being made, right? You've been tracking this. Can you help us understand the details a little better?
Sure, absolutely. I'd like to just make it a quick overview, because ultimately this investigation is quite light on facts and has a lot of conjecture and a lot of maybe, could be, potential, these sort of words are there in their report. As I see it, it's not conclusive in any way. As you have said, that nearly 50,000 people are there on this list of potential targets who could be possibly or maybe being spied on. And yes, it spans governments across the globe, but there is no trace that there's no evidence that any one particular government is spying on any one particular individual. That link has not been established as yet. What we do know is that a very small subset of phones, around I think 37, if I'm not mistaken, have been infected with this spyware. But taking that forward into the Indian context, we have not actually seen those who apparently or allegedly have been on this list take those their own phones and submit them for forensic investigation. And there's a lot of noise around the fact that perhaps this government has been spying on this set of journalists and so-called activists, but there and sometimes politicians as well, some from both the Congress and the BJP. But we have not actually been able to establish that this government has been spying at all on this group, and it's all pretty circumstantial based on a list. The source of that list, we still don't know where that's actually come from. So as we have seen this story, it kind of broke on The Guardian through The Wire here in India, which was quote unquote their partner, according to one of the Guardian journalists. What ended up happening was that after the first day where Modi's photo was on the on the front page of The Guardian, the next day it was not followed up with any further details on the Pegasus story, because I don't think it really held too much water to the extent that it could have follow-up stories. The only one of the few countries where it actually ended up having follow-up stories was in India, right? So I think that there are a lot of things which we can unpack around this, why it's happening, and I look forward to hearing what Karan has to say on this topic.
Karan, you want to come in?
Yeah, sure. So what I'll do is probably just step back a bit and kind of give a brief background on what's happening in the world around the world of signal intelligence. And I think we must appreciate the fact that there is a reason why governments adopt this kind of technology. Now, I'm not getting into whether it's Pegasus or anything else, but just to step back and to see why do governments do this. I think it's a fact that India has been the largest recipient of terrorism in the world. We've been having terror attacks on our nation for the last 30 years. I've done some research on this. And just in the last 20 years, up until 2013, we were attacked 6,024 times, terror attacks. Now, that's some serious amount of terrorism on our nation. But the West really didn't recognize this and thought of it as a policing problem. till 9/11 hit the Americans. And that's when the world woke up and said, okay, there is a serious issue out here. And then last 20 years, even the Americans and in fact, the globe, if you look at France, if you look at the United Kingdom, most nations have come under terror attacks. What has happened post 2014, or at least in the last 7 years, that surprisingly, there's not been a single terror attack on any Indian city in the public. So you had this era of 20 years of 6,000 attacks, and suddenly the last 7 years, you've had no terror attacks. By the way, this does not include some of the terror attacks that have happened on army installations. So of course, there was Pulwama and there have been Uri. I'm not talking about that, but no terror attacks in Delhi, none in Bombay, nothing in Bangalore, Lucknow. And there is not a single city in this country that had not come under attack. So I think the background of this is that we must try and appreciate why does a government or an agency adopt these technologies? And the reason for that is to protect its people from attacks. Now, look at what happened in Pulwama. Once the attack happened, there was this deluge of criticism against the government that there was no intelligence gathered. So, you know, you can't have it both ways, that you kind of accuse the government of not having intelligence. And when they create an apparatus for gathering intelligence, you accuse them of freedom of speech, etc. The reason why I bring this up is this is not about Pegasus. If you look at three programs running globally, and I'm going to name those programs, those are some of the largest surveillance programs ever done in the world. The number one is PRISM. PRISM program started in the US. It still continues. Of course, it's dwindling down. They have actual surveillance on hundreds of millions of their US citizens, including Facebook. And so they have access to hundreds of millions of US citizens. The second big program is called the Five Eyes, where five nations have pooled their intelligence together on signals. The United Kingdom, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and the United States. It's called Five Eyes, and they've kind of really, you know, got the world together on sharing signal intelligence. And the third big name is Huawei, which is like the Chinese sponsor for surveillance programs. So Pegasus is the fourth one in some ways. And perhaps governments that could not build signal intelligence on their own probably went and bought something which was available. And that's the background. I think a lot's been kind of made out of the program in the sense as if it is not meant for counterterrorism and it's only meant for surveillance of civilians or, for that matter, journalists. That's a little naive to believe because it is a weapon. In a way, it is a weapon to protect your nation against attacks. And I would think that India's done remarkably well not to come under attack. There are so many reports where terror cells and hubs have been kind of found ahead of time, many in UP, many sometimes in Delhi, sometimes in Jammu, sometimes in Kashmir. And it's not easy to keep a nation like India protected, certainly after, you know, you've had numerous attacks. So I think in my opening statement, I just like to say that Pegasus is not the only spy software available in the world. Many others and many, many much more powerful and deeply entrenched into society. So surveillance under PRISM is in millions. And this is just 50,000 if we took it on face value.
Right.
And the primary objective is safeguarding citizens. Does it have other ramifications? Possible. Does India fall in that gamut? And does it kind of, can we accuse, you know, the government of an overreach? Perhaps not because of the points that Surya just made.
Right. Yeah, fantastic opening remarks. And certainly it opens up the discussion to explore other nuances, right? Surya, you made a very important distinction, right? Which is that these phone numbers have not been tracked. They're on a list that says that these were potentially tracked, right? These haven't been proven, right? As in, I mean, these phones have not been submitted or, you know, forensic investigation has not happened. At this point of time, it's, you know, as you put it, it's perhaps conjecture to say that, you know, these people were potentially tracked, right? So why do you think that detail has sort of escaped a lot of people's attention, right? Do you think that, you know, there is no real way of actually validating that these have been tracked and, we should really take note of this anyway?
Well, you know, This comes down to a broader issue about the ethics of journalism and the purpose of certain types of journalism. And this also fits into the context of what parts of the wider audience are being targeted for certain types of, whether it's information or disinformation. I'm talking about it from a very broad perspective. We have seen the evolution of mainstream media in a way which it's gone on a trajectory which perhaps we have not expected, right? We've been used to a certain type of mainstream media over a period of several years. Now we have digital platforms that call themselves independent media outlets that need to gain some sort of legitimacy and are fighting for that. I'm not taking any names here, but you know, you could take some guesses as to which ones need money to run certain operations. And some of those operations are regime change operations. Just like how mainstream media outlets, for example, during the Reagan era, were actively using PSYOPs based on declassified documents to push certain agendas with the public. They use pseudonyms in TIV, who apparently wrote columns in mainstream media, in mainstream newspapers, to run anti-communist propaganda. During the Vietnam War, they ran, for example, pro-war articles when especially the American public was going against, the American involvement in the region. There's a history of this throughout time. The disinformation is a normal part of what governments use to kind of push certain agendas. But now it's not just governments, they're individuals. The whole digital medium has opened up the platform to agents to kind of push on their own accord for regime change. I would not say that this Pegasus is any different, because when it's based on, it's not based on hard evidence. There's no actually trace that goes back to who has leaked this, these 50,000 names, and from where this list has been leaked from, because the NSO says that it's not been leaked from their database. So where has this list come from? It could have just come out of thin air for all we know. I mean, the journalists may, if they really want to present an irrefutable case, they should actually come out and say, this is what our source is. At least allude to the source. They haven't done that. So the purpose of this is to pretty much throw as much as you can at governments to kind of delegitimize their effort, as Scudden really was talking about, to counter terrorism. It's meant to actually defang governments and prevent them from actually getting involved in counterterrorism and anti-criminal activity. And that, I think, is quite dangerous. So they want to target a certain group, which is kind of like the gullible masses, who in many ways would say that, oh, the government is snooping on us because there is a question mark around this list. Then there's another group, which is the think tank and other media groups who kind of take this and kind of repeat it again and again to auto-suggest to not just the public, but to kind of create, ruckus, for example, in parliament, right? Disrupt government proceedings, right? That's at one level. You can't get the public to do it, so you get political parties to do it. Then at another level, you hope that it sticks with other governments who will come in and lecture, for example, India, on how human rights need to be respected. And as Scudden, definitively discussed here, he said that, the U.S. is running these surveillance programs. They've run it in the past. They continue to run them. But I think we can just take it from there and see how, address some other questions.
Yeah, I mean, it was touted to be the silver bullet, right? That would hurt the government. I mean, and there was a sort of a coordinated build-up to it, right? From various corners, right? And it hasn't had the impact, at least up until now, that, one would have, at least people who were hoping that it would have such an impact really would have gathered at this point of time, right? So Karan, you brought up an important point on terrorism and, safety and national interest, right? And I was thinking about RVS Money's book. He was part of the Home Ministry around 2006, and he talks about all of these different attacks. And it's a stark contrast to, you know, the last 7 years where, you know, fortunately, we haven't had any of these, right? So, and there is that sort of a trade-off. But the larger point you are making is that this is the world that we live in right now, right? What do you tell people who would, you know, say that, hey, you know, that could be used as an excuse to, you know, trespass on our privacy, and, you know, that also violates our basic fundamental rights and so on, right? So how do you thread that argument?
So, I mean, it's let me just start with a little bit of a technical difference out here. I think surveillance and hacking are two different worlds. Legally, you're allowed to do surveillance as a nation, as a state, as an executive and as a judicial requirement. Surveillance is allowed, provided you tick mark certain aspects of, you know, taking permissions, etc. Hacking is actually not allowed in the legal technical way of looking at things. So it depends on how, whether, you know, it comes under the world of surveillance or hacking, et cetera, et cetera. I don't want to really go there, but I think as citizens, our primary objective, I mean, if you just look at it from an Indian's point of view, as a citizen of this nation, I just want to live in a protected environment. If that means there is some infringement in my privacy, would I be jumping up and down, knowing fully well that this may protect the lives of my loved ones and the life of fellow Indians? I think that's a trade-off. I'm not saying that as an individual, I'm open to the idea of being pried upon, but there are certain aspects that are necessary for protection. And the point I just keep raising in this discussion is there is a huge economic cost on every terror attack, whether in India or abroad. And there are detailed studies that have been done on this. One single large terror attack takes away 1.5% GDP and 2% of investment growth in that year for that country. I think I'm just kind of extending that conversation from where Surya left and said that there are many agendas out here. One of the agendas of a terror attack is to slow down the economic growth of a nation. So it's not just about, you know, three people coming and shooting down 83 people. It's about putting shackles around a nation's growth. And at some stage, India has to wake up and kind of take steps to protect itself. You may call it nationalism, you may call it whichever word you want to, but there are certain steps mandatorily needed to be taken. It seems as if we've been successful in those steps, whether they came from Israeli help or American intelligence, whether we pried into the, you know, the lives of 7 journalists and 8 ministers. I will not get into that discussion, but as an Indian, as a citizen of this nation, I want to live in a safe and secure environment devoid of any more attacks. It may infringe in my privacy. That probably is something I'm willing to live with. Does this affect the masses? I think the answer to that is no. There is no political, I don't think it's such a massive political issue that will wake up the masses and kind of get them to say that, oh, what the hell, why are you prying into my life? But I completely agree with Surya that there is an attempt to throw as much as possible in the hope that something would stick. For example, the Rafael controversy. There was this huge controversy created around the corruption issue of Rafael. At the time of Donald Trump's visit to India, there was this huge controversy recreated around NRC. Delhi riots happened. 51 people lost their lives. So I think it's very important, Roshan, for us to, as a nation, be very cognizant of the fact that there will be attempts made repeatedly to make it sound as if we live in a surveillance state, to make it sound as if many of our rights have been infringed upon. But it seems as if all of those are making us a stronger, more protected nation, is the way I look at it.
Right. Let's talk about some of the reactions to this, right? Surya, you were mentioning the list earlier, right? So it's a fairly diverse list, right? I mean, it has a motley bunch of people, everyone from Rahul Gandhi to Praveen Togadia to Abhishek Banerjee, right? They're three people that you never thought you would mention in one sentence, right? But it has Ashwini Vaishnav, for example, who is part of the government right now. And then journalists like Paranjay Thakurta, M.K. Venu, Rohini Singh, and so on. Any comments on the people itself on this list?
This is the exact question that kind of has been doing the rounds. Like, you know, what do you make of the list and the people on it? I actually would take a slightly different line compared to many others when answering this question. I'd say that the list actually doesn't matter because as of now, we have not established any link between the government of India and that it could have been a foreign government, a foreign, any foreign player who has paid a spy firm to potentially hack their phones. Because there is no evidence at the moment, I think that the list could be concocted. It could be actually a subset of a much larger list, perhaps. So just those names and the sort of balance of political leanings of the people on that list, I think it will actually not give us the full picture because we don't know the entire story. So as of now, these media organizations are running with half-baked stories in order to create a very post-truth sort of environment based on that, okay, you know, you used to believe that you had privacy. We are people who, and the majority of the people out here on this list are dissidents. We dissent against this government. Hence, we are being spied upon because we could be potential targets. That's the link which they're making, right? And there's that. I mean, this entire argument is flawed, and which is why I won't make any insinuations about the list itself. And I don't think that it would be prudent for anyone to really go out there and make a conclusive statement on this.
The timing of all of this is pretty dubious as well, right? I mean, we have the monsoon session that was totally disrupted. In fact, I mean, I think as Ashwini Vaishnav rose up to speak, the TMC member snatched away his papers. There was a lot of ruckus itself, right? The opposition is sort of playing it up, right? I mean, again, question to either of you guys. Do you think that, you know, I mean, there was the timing of this is dubious? And also, I mean, how do you see the opposition sort of capitalizing on this issue to score any political points as such?
Yeah, so I really think that this is where the opposition kind of gets it wrong, in a sense that the belief that matters like these really kind of whip up sentiment within the public. I mean, at some stage, the opposition's really got to get constructive. Look at the irony of it, Roshan, that the opposition even opposed the removal of Section 370. Forget Pegasus for a minute. I mean, look at what they did on 370. They're not even united on something that can really, I mean, that across the length and breadth of the nation, every citizen feels was the right thing to do. So you really don't expect much from the opposition but to oppose. And this is now standard part and parcel of the last 7-8 years that has been, it's just pretty much the same pattern. So I'm really not surprised with this. In fact, no one's really surprised, which is, it's like routine matters. So today it was Pegasus. Prior to that, it was the farm laws. Before that, it was 370. Prior to that, it was demonetization, GST. So they've got an issue with everything. The sad part is that in this cry wolf, some serious issues probably also get overlooked. So something where the opposition can really make a serious dent into the government also kind of gets lost. So for example, there's work that the government needs to do on the economic front. I mean, this is a session to use this time and kind of pin the government down on some of its economic policies, or for that matter, some other serious policies. But no, that's not what they want to do. They want to kind of make it sound as if the central government is out here kind of creating a surveillance nation. Let me add one thing. What is a surveillance nation? I think let the audience get an idea of what is a surveillance nation. If you go to a very minor intersection, a bus stand in a small city or a town inside of China, you will be greeted with some not less than 250 cameras, which will capture every movement of that person on that bus stop, which is perhaps 6 people. So I'm talking about a very minor bus stop intersection. So that's a surveillance state. All of the discussion is to kind of give a perspective that I think the opposition is losing the plot, kind of opposing virtually everything. And in some sense, not really winning the intellectual capacity to hold the government responsible on some 2 or 3 matters that they could really, really push them hard on. So that's my view on I think what the opposition is all about right now.
Surya, you could add to this. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, Roshan. I think that Karan raises two very important points. One is about the ineptitude of the opposition at the moment. And I use that as, it's a strong word, but I use it because it's very unfortunate that an opposition in a country that's, you know, with 1.4 billion people, where the opposing parties have got nearly 60% of the vote, you know, in the last Lok Sabha election, they're not representing the people's interest. It's very unfortunate, because when you represent the people's interest, you should be, that's basically looking for the development and the future goodwill for the future good of the people who voted for you and for the nation as a whole. And that is clearly missing when frivolous issues, and I do say that this Pegasus issue is a frivolous issue at the moment, because there is no evidence to back it. It ends up washing out an entire day or a few days of the monsoon session. I think that's a great disservice to the people. And each time this happens, the people take note of it. In fact, the opposition is actually straying further and further away from being elected into positions of influence and power again. They don't seem to be learning the lesson. And as Karan had mentioned, the people in many ways are not that concerned about some of these issues around privacy, as long as those issues are not going to have a deleterious impact on their lives immediately. If it is for national security, if it is, they think that perhaps is fair, and they trust the government. The idea of this operation by certain journalists was meant to demean or degrade the trust that people have in the government. I think that it has had very little impact, but the opposition thinks that it can have an impact, which is why they're playing it up in the park. And I think that's unfortunate.
No, I think I agree with both of you, right? I mean, if you were to ask the man on the street or the woman on the street, for instance, right, how much they would care about something like this, I think you would be hard-pressed to find someone who really, really would prioritize this as a sort of an electoral issue, right? I mean, something that would affect the government or impact the government. And in that sense, I think both the opposition and people who are antagonistic to the government are probably barking up the wrong tree here again. Let's talk about the government's reactions itself, right? I think Home Minister Amit Shah said that this was a concerted effort by, you know, he called it disruptors and obstructors against the progress of India, right? And I think we had, you know, reactions from the External Affairs Ministry as well. Meenakshi Lekhiji said that, you know, it was linked to the Personal Data Protection Bill, and, you know, that it should be examined and so on, right? So Surya, let me come to you first, and then Karan, you can add, right? What do you make of the reactions from the government itself? How have they handled it? And do you think, you know, that there's some things that could be better in this?
I think that government communication can always be improved. There's scope for that. We have seen that often the media has the kind of first mover advantage, and the government tends to be a bit reactionary. And ironically, had the government been snooping on these journalists, they probably would have known that this story was going to break, and they probably could have preempted it. So but in classic trajectory that this government has taken, they tend to be a little reactive. They came out and they flatly denied it. And I think that the minister's statement on the floor of the House was very categoric. It was followed up by, you know, the next day by an individual who came up and tore up the paper. And I think that they ended up and the TNC MP was shown the door for a year now out of the floor. So I think that the government has made their stand very clear. I think that the public is not particularly interested in the story. I would actually not say that the government has fared poorly on their communication on this. Perhaps, when it comes to issues related to their contracts with foreign firms, if they have any, for the purpose of surveillance, I think that the government has to be as tight-lipped as possible, right? If they are involved. If they're not involved, whatever they have said is still equally valid. Right? The denial of the thing. I think that they've done a decent job this time. I would not say the same in other cases, but for this particular instance, I would say yes. They've been able.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's often, you know, discussed issue that, you know, the government doesn't communicate as well. Right. But this, you know, just to use cricketing terminology, I think the batsman did not even have to block the ball. I mean, it was a no ball anyway. What do you make of reactions from outside of the country? You know, I mean, we have the U.S. Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, who will be visiting shortly. I think 27th is when he's expected to meet Prime Minister Modi and discuss issues around Afghanistan and some of the vaccine-related stuff as well, right? So do you think this will be brought up? I think some people are hoping that, you know, he will raise human rights objections and so on and so forth. Do you think that this could be used as a sort of a cudgel to sort of wield against the government itself? And do you think any of this matters, actually, for India?
We have so many issues, serious issues to deal with that I really doubt any of this will even feature in the actual discussions. Of course, a press release around it is a different matter altogether. But remember, Anthony Blinken's coming here at a very sensitive time, at a time when India is seeking a role for itself in Afghanistan, and rightly so. It's also coming at a time when when the Quad is really starting to take shape in a more meaningful manner. He's also coming at a time when vaccine diplomacy might be coming back onto India's doorsteps. Because remember, in March, we were exporting to 70-odd countries. In April, we obviously shut that down. There are many, many things that are, there are many wheels within wheels that are functioning right now. And I don't think this visit is all about discussing India's human rights policies right now, because like I said, TRISM is pretty much the definition of trying to infringe into lives of people. So, but this visit is really, really important. I think the visit in itself is very important because the agenda items are very serious. And I think the number one on that agenda item is Afghanistan. And there is now a legitimate role for India to play out there. So while this is outside of the Pegasus discussion, but my guess is that that's an area we should really look out for, because if we expect that the Chinese, along with the Pakistan regime, will kind of take care of Afghanistan, then they're really living in fool's paradise. And Americans realize it. They also realize India's importance in the Indian-Ocean region, which is, you know, which is where the whole Quad fits in. So suddenly India's in the centerpiece of this, of this entire jigsaw puzzle of making sure Afghanistan is stable, but while taking on China in its own turf, which is the South China Sea. So actually, we really assumed a lot of importance as a nation for where we are the only nation which is actually pushed back on the Chinese in any way, whether it was Galwan, whether it was banning apps, et cetera, et cetera. So actually, India is now at the forefront of all of this. So it's just going to be a continuation of probably of what happened under the Trump era. And I'm not really sure Pegasus would form any meaningful conversation in that sense.
Right.
Now, and the fascinating thing here is, just to add one very quick point to what you were saying, we have an intelligence sharing agreement with the United States.
That's correct. Right? That's correct.
And yeah, I'll just leave it at that.
You know, And Surya, very interestingly, signed on the last few days of under the Trump administration. The topic of India has bipartisan approvals between the two houses. So in that sense, we are really, really critical. Otherwise, they won't have signed all those agreements just as the presidential election was taking place. Now, so you're absolutely right. And these are serious intelligence sharing agreements. I mean, this includes access to satellites, which very, very few countries in the world have access to. So Pegasus kind of looks really small when it comes to some mega intelligence sharing.
Yeah. So, you know, continuing on the reactions itself, right? What do you guys make of the media reaction? I mean, we had a comment from the Editors Guild of India demanding, and again, I'm quoting, you know, what they said, a deep introspection into the kind of society we are heading towards, right? You know, it's being positioned as an attempt to undermine the quality of the quality and the power of journalism that we have, and to sort of consolidate power away from Indian media, right? So, Surya, what do you make of that specifically?
The less said about the Editors Guild right now, I think the better. But in terms of the broader issue that they raised, I think you know, it's a healthy debate on journalism and the state of it in India. It's very valid. It's an ongoing and continuous discussion that should always be held, right? I don't think that that's something that you know, the public should shy away from, but it needs to be looked at in context of you know, like this particular scandal, this so-called scandal, the Pegasus one, and what exactly that means for press freedom. Now, we have seen international organizations downrate India repeatedly on press freedom. Now, that happens alongside the an acceleration in the number and diversity of the Indian media outlets that exist. So we're seeing them rise in number, and we're seeing them, you know, kind of take on a more important role as a pillar in Indian democracy. But yet, India's press freedom keeps dropping, which to me, I'm not able to reconcile these two. Perhaps it's because there are more complaints as well, about the state of democracy. But at the same time, you have more people who can come out and voice themselves and report and do and report as they like in many ways. Now, the fine balance that exists between national security, as Karan was talking about, and ensuring press freedom is imperative to hold. And that balance is not something that's easy to maintain. In fact, the unfortunate thing here really is that sections of the media are trying to tilt that balance in favor of a certain group within the media space at the expense of national security. It will be it'll naturally fall at the expense of national security. Now, who benefits from this, right? I'm not making any insinuations, but I'm asking the question, who benefits from a weaker India, right? Who benefits if there are terror attacks in the country after 7 years, right? Yeah. Which political party benefits, which media outlet benefits? Now, we have to understand that destabilizing the state is a core agenda for certain groups.
Right.
And throwing as much mud, hoping that something sticks, is one of their core strategies. And this is not any different from that.
Right. And I think, you know, prominent countries have, global powers have said as much that it's part of their foreign policy, right? I mean, to influence media opinion, to influence public opinion through all of these sort of ways and means, right? And I mean, I found it kind of, I thought it was ridiculous that, you know, we were lumped along with Saudi Arabia, Uganda, and Azerbaijan, right? In this whole sort of a fiasco. So Karan, I want to come to another point, which is that, you know, I mean, we've heard MK Venu, for example, the founding editor of The Wire, and whose phone was apparently alleged to be tracked, right? I mean, he said that there should be an inquiry, otherwise we'll go to the courts, right? Do you see a larger issue here where, you know, a bunch of PILs might be filed and, you know, I mean, we've already seen the judiciary sort of like overreach on certain things. And do you see this potentially impair the government's working in that sense? I mean, anything that could come out of that?
When is it that a certain legislation has come out or something's amiss and the judicial overreach has not happened? I mean, it's happened on virtually every occasion, including farmers' laws, where the judiciary has to step in and kind of say, we'll create a committee. So this is no different. They went into, like I said, the Rafael corruption case as well, and then kind of exonerated the government. And they'll obviously do this all over again. So it is now a national pastime. It seems that there is a certain sequence. There will be a ruckus created and the judicial step in, etc. But now that's part and parcel. I think even this government pretty much recognizes the sequence of steps. And it's now found a way to work around this. It's nothing new. It's the point I'm trying to make, Roshan. I also just wanted to go back to one of the questions you asked, Surya, around the journalists, etc., and the media kick up around this entire issue. Actually, what we're missing out is one name, not of a person, but of a supposed NGO, which is Amnesty International. So it's not just The Guardian and The Wire. The real proponent of this is Amnesty International, which is supposed to kind of have civil rights as its main agenda. And what people tend to forget very quickly is that this is the same Amnesty International which stopped India's nuclear plant in Kudankulam. It started this project in 2002. It took 2016 is when we reignited that entire nuclear power plant project, which got stalled because of Amnesty International in India. And finally, that program is taking off now. In fact, newspaper articles only suggested that Manmohan Singh in the UPA era had suggested that Amnesty International should probably be banned in India. So it's the same Amnesty International along with The Guardian and The Wire, which has bought out the Pegasus report. So you can imagine, I mean, like Surya said, you've got to connect the dots and see who's working in favor of the nation. And this is all part of, so you really don't have to have a terrorist attack to protect yourself. These are forms of attacks and these are forms of keeping India kind of, you know, entangled in so many pieces, etc. So I think which is where the governments recognize this and they don't tend to stop. and communicate their agenda every time. They tend to take steps, give enough time, and they move on. One thing, Surya, and I think I want your view also in this, and Roshan, step in if you think the view is correct here. I agree with you, Surya, that the communication's not the very best, but I think the governments figure out that if they got entangled in kind of explaining each and every aspect, then their ability to take decisions and move on gets impaired. So it seems to me that they bring out a certain legislation, answer it at the right place, which is in the House, and then they move on to the next. So it is their communication strategy in a way. It doesn't appeal to you and me, which is right, because, as citizens, we want more. But it seems as if they found this way out. Do you kind of agree with that?
I think that it works for certain issues, right? Like in the case of Pegasus, this scandal, I think their strategy, I think, has been spot on. It's been on point. But when it comes to other issues around, for example, 370, right? And I'm not talking about domestically in India. I'm talking about what the narrative they should have built very carefully over the years, because they knew that this was on the cards. This was one of their manifesto commitments. So it should have been, in my opinion, something that they carefully crafted a narrative overseas about exactly why it's important, why the laws that are enshrined in 35 and 370 are regressive and repressive, and why the state needs to be unshackled from these repressive laws. Now, when you come in and you make a rearrangement, and legitimately so, it kind of, the narrative which we know has already that has been built by Pakistan, by Amnesty as well in India about Jammu and Kashmir, about the MPs in the British Parliament who have been working closely with the Pakistanis or the America or the Pakistan caucus in the US, the lobbies that exist in the US, which actually are quite powerful.
Very powerful.
The Pakistanis spend a lot of money lobbying.
Yes, perhaps. So true.
And they are in touch with very specific groups that actually have a significant amount of clout, even like especially now, amongst the Democrats. And there should have been. I mean, obviously, this was done in 2019, and Trump was around at that point. But still, right? Like, the narrative could have been built in a better way so that it could have made the process a little easier, right? You don't need to have New York Times or Washington Post or Wall Street Journal putting out biased articles which are actually bereft of actual ground realities. Talking about the number of stone pelting incidents actually had reduced during this period, post August 5th, but that didn't seem to matter. It there was a narrative that was constructed. Nothing really about the repressive laws that that precluded Valmikis from the Dalits and people, women from access, LGBTQ from accessing equal rights. That, where did that narrative go? It just went into thin air. Why is our narrative about Pakistan occupied Jammu and Kashmir not being central to every single report or out there in the media on Jammu and Kashmir? Jammu and Kashmir it's only talked about Kashmir and the Kashmir Valley that is with India. Nobody ever talks about Gilgit Baltistan or the rest of it. This is a communications failure, in my opinion, right? And I don't know exactly how this can be improved, because this should have been started from day one. You have had 7 years. This should have built up steadily over 7 years, and we should be at a very different place today.
Right. I think. Go ahead, Karan.
I've been thinking about this. I mean, it is a really important aspect, and I just want to say that. So look at this conversation today itself under Bharat Varta. The fact that we're able to do this conversation is also reflective that things may not necessarily change with the government, but communities will come together and kind of put messages out there for the wider audience to kind of take in and soak in. And the minute you tend to do that and kind of put a counter view, it seems as if the media is under attack. That's exactly how it's played out, that there's a freedom of speech issue, and there's a freedom of expression. And I find that very strange, because there's not a single instance where the central government's kind of come down on a journalist if he's been very critical of, let's say, the prime minister or the home minister. But there are so many cases where a journalist gone behind bars in a state if the journalist spoke against the chief minister. So it's so counterintuitive that, you know, states that have actually put chief ministers have put certain journalists behind bars and not the central government. So I think we're in a bit of a stage where different aspects of communication and media are starting to emerge. And all of this will take some time, because it is in a way a bit of a new India, so to speak. And we'll kind of meander and find our way through. But I totally agree that the government's communication skills and their ability to put their message out for the wider audience definitely needs improvement. No doubt about it.
Just one quick point on this, Karan. You know, like, it needs improvement. You take, for example, what, you know, our external affairs minister, Dr. Jaishankar, did. When he went, he spoke to think tanks in the U.S., right? And he told them exactly what was the real narrative. You know, he did his best to communicate. But when you have, and he openly did say, even later on, I remember in an interview, he said, my reputation is not set by a newspaper in New York. Right.
So true.
And I think that there, perhaps part of their strategy is that, look, we will communicate the way we want to. Everyone else, if they want to communicate around it the way they like, that's up to them. But we are self-confident enough to make our own decisions, and without having to slowly put set narratives in a certain way out there. You know, before we
no, that set. Is true. That is true. It is.
It is self-confidence as well.
Yeah, you could absolutely, and I would kind of tend to agree with you that this is also about probably saying I'm doing the right things, and this is the way it is, and then you can form your own opinions, because it is the media's prerogative to report it in the manner that they wish to. That is true freedom of speech, I guess. On that point, and I'm just going to take a quick minute. Surya, you mentioned this important point about the foreign minister and, you know, the way they've gone about it. It's very interesting, and we've kind of overlooked something that's just happened in the recent ministry overhaul. In the external affairs ministry now, there are four ministers of state, which has never happened in the past. No, never has India given so much importance to the external affairs ministry. So for the first time, what they're really doing is strengthening the ministry such that the projection of the Indian state can be divided and each minister of state can take bigger responsibility. So it's something that has happened for the first time post 70 years of our independence.
Right.
Yeah. No, this is an interesting detour, right? And we've done more than a couple of episodes on, you know, press freedom, crafting our national narrative. One that I can recall is the one with Ruchir Sharma and Vishal Ganeshan. So for anyone who's listening, do check out those podcasts. And, you know, just to add my two cents to everything that, you know, Karan and Surya just said, I think we're entirely charitable with state governments, right? In comparison to the center, the government at the center, right? So, you know, I remember at least, you know, probably 10 or 15 years back when, you know, a senior journalist I knew almost, you know, used to joke about the fact that his phones were tapped, right? I mean, it was pretty much understood, right? And that's the sort of world that we're living in. I mean, to act surprised betrays a bit of a naivety, I would say. Or I don't know what to make of that other than that. So, you know, just to sort of close the loop on this conversation, right? Given that we exist in this world and, you know, we have to sort of prepare for whatever, either on the national interest, national security side of things or geopolitical side of things, should we then be proactive and develop some of this capability ourselves, right? Because if you look at what the NSO group says, it's sold only to vetted governments, right? And of course, I mean, we have great relationships with Israel. So that certainly adds to, you know, adds to us in this fact. But then, I mean, do we have to, like, you know, invest in building these capabilities ourselves more proactively? Again, a question to either of you. I mean, anyone if you can come in on this.
I think these, first, we must recognize that these are extremely expensive technologies to build ground up. And it's not just about signals intelligence. I was talking about some of the intelligence gathering mechanisms through satellite imagery, etc. Those are really, really tough to build ground up and expensive. And then they require a network, which is a global network, something like the Five Eyes, which the Americans already have. Signing of those agreements and being part of an infrastructure that gives you access are some of the steps that the government has taken to kind of address that issue. And I just want to make this one last remark that in a way, it's a departure from the past. Past 70 years, we've been in the non-aligned kind of structure. But I think as a nation, we're beginning to now head towards taking sides. And this is a big departure from what we've done in the past, while retaining strategic autonomy, etc. But I don't think India will kind of continue on the path of non-alignment anymore. The time for taking sides is starting to appear. And the fact that we're signing such mega agreements with Israelis and the Americans, and that has resulted in a safer nation, at least in the last 7 years, suggests that we seem to be on the right path. In many ways, Roshan, that kind of answers the question that do we build this ground up or do we kind of participate in an umbrella structure that that ropes us in as well. I think we're headed there.
Right. Yeah. Final comments to you, Surya, and then, you know, we can close.
You know, on this particular question that you asked, I think that it would be good if we indigenize some of these capabilities, we build it ground up. I take a slightly more conservative view on India's on the need for strategic autonomy. I think, you know, I envision that as, you know, the second or third largest economy in the world within the next, definitely within the next 15 to 20 years, the third largest, and, you know, perhaps even the second largest within the next 50 years, we need to indigenize a lot, and we need to become a pole in the multipolar world ourselves without having to, I mean, of course, international relationships and partnerships are absolutely important. The United States also never was able to grow to the size that it did without these partnerships, especially in the security domain. But I do think that, you know, the more we indigenize, the more we rely on ourselves, the less we rely on others, the more we will have room to more wiggle room to do what we want. You know, you take, for example, I just wanted to give a small example because you see what the US has done. For example, Huawei. Huawei is getting a chance to almost rehabilitate itself through hiring a very powerful lobbyist in the US,
right,
who's aligned with the Democrats, who might be able to give them a backdoor into, you know, the fold, right? This is something which, for example, does not exist in India, right? A foreign company which, for example, has been definitely involved in mass surveillance, almost to the point of enabling human rights abuse in occupied Xinjiang, and in other parts of the world, they've kind of supported the Iranian regime in building their surveillance system, perhaps even the North Koreans. This is a submission by the DOJ. Right, they have been given an opportunity to almost rehabilitate themselves through official channels. We don't have these sort of systems in India. If we choose to do something to protect our national interests, like how we did, which is shutting out Huawei from 5G trials, banning apps from the China, by the, you know, the Chinese have kind of inundated the market with in India, we have a unique ability to choose our own path, and we can do it in a very determined fashion, and the public rallies behind it. We have seen that with the Chinese apps that we have banned. We can do that with even American apps, should we want to, at a later point in time.
Sure.
And I think that keeps the Americans a little bit off balance sometimes. When they know that there's a strong leadership in India that can make a decision and have the buy-in of 1.4 billion people. And it could be at the expense of American corporates. And I think that we need to get to ourselves, get to a point where we can do this. If we can do this, we actually keep other powers at bay and kind of, but during this process of us building ourselves up, we will be under constant pressure, whether it is Dean Thomas from the State Department, who says that they're going to talk to us about human rights and the Pegasus scandal, right? Or, you know, the constant carping by Western media outlets. It will happen more and more and more as any sort of strong Indian leadership remains in power that can make independent decisions and preserve our true strategic autonomy.
All right, that's an interesting note to end the podcast on. And as with, I think, most important things that we discuss, we finish a 60-minute discussion and we realize it throws up more questions than we had, earlier, right? So this was a very interesting conversation. Thank you so much, Karan and Surya, for joining us and walking us through all of the nuances. It was a pleasure hosting you. Thank you.
Thank you. Really enjoyed. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Roshan. And good to speak to you, Karan, on this topic.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Bharat Varta podcast. If you want to see more content like this, then don't forget to subscribe to our channel. We started Bharat Varta to facilitate long-form discussions on politics, policy, and culture. We don't necessarily endorse anything that was said in this episode. If you wish to offer us feedback, do reach out to us on social media. We are at Bharat Varta on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You could also get in touch with us on our website, www.bharatvarta.in. The links are in the description below. Until next time, stay safe, take care, and Jai Hind.